We are looking at the topic of prayer. I may have mentioned this, but I received a request from a Christian magazine to write an article on prayer, which kind of stunned me. You know, I'm like, and I wrote back quite simply, no. Because if I went to all the trouble to write it, you wouldn't publish it. The problem is prayer is an untouchable subject to write about or teach about. Because if you say something contrary to somebody's established practice, they become highly offended. And sometimes rightfully so. So when I talk about prayer here, I'm not trying to attack your personal practice. Your personal practice may be awesome. There may be something you've developed between you and God that is very much different than other people are comfortable with. And I'm not trying to attack that. But there is a point where we talked about it a little bit last week, we can offend God. If you remember, I've read here, and I'm not going to read it today. I'll discipline myself not to read it. But the first chapter of Isaiah, remember this? You guys don't remember, but I should read it anyway. But he says, in there, he says, and he's condemning their sacrifices and all the ritual they do. And in there, he says, and when you stretch out your hands to pray to me, I will not listen. Now, that is not a sentence from God that I want to hear. I will not listen. I want him to listen to me. But he's not saying I won't listen because you're not worthy or because you've offended me. You know, I'm just upset with you. He's saying you're not focusing on me anymore. You're just doing religious ritual, and I have no place for that in our relationship. It's a cheap substitute. We can understand that a little bit in our marriages or our deepest friendships. If there's no focus, no mindfulness of the other person, just a superficial acknowledgement that they're there. And you have all fallen into this, I believe. Maybe not all of you. I forget about you guys. But I have fallen into where I'm not paying as much attention as I should to the person I'm talking with. Don't ask my wife about that because she'll agree with me. But I'm superficially acknowledging. And then, I don't know, have any of you ever done this? The person isn't quite finished with what they're saying and you're answering their question? Now, this is what we call rude. Either that or omniscient. But since I'm not omniscient, for me, it's just plain rude. So I have to get back to the point where I am listening to the person who's talking to me. When it comes to God, I'm listening to what he says. I don't think I already know what he says, so I'm going to do it in advance. There might be some things he has to teach me I haven't learned yet. So we are looking at the subject of prayer, not with the criticizing things that have worked for you, but just to think a little bit deeper maybe about some of the practices you have or in some cases you don't have. I quoted my grandson a couple times, and I love the quote, so I'll touch it again. When in terms of prayer, he said, is God really there or are we just pretending? And that's just a good quote, because I think if you have never asked that question, I don't think your faith is very deep. I think at some point or another, most of us have said, is God really there or are we just pretending? And the idea of prayer is the interaction with him. And over time, we can slowly gain the confidence that he is really there. Now, there's a lot of things I don't know about God, but there's a lot of things I think God has touched me and I know he's there. I have a lot of questions daily, but overall, I know he's there. He's been with me. I got a book for Christmas, and it's called something like Great Crimes in History or something like that. It was given to me by my uncle. And the purpose isn't to describe the crime. The purpose is to describe the state of evil that gets inside of us. And some of these guys are really quite rude, you know, like somebody cuts them off in traffic, so they just go kill them, you know. I think that's a little extreme myself, but I've been tempted. I'm sorry. I was trying to make it back from Homer yesterday to speak at that little graduation thing and I got behind a boat, and there was like 30 cars after the boat and then me. And I felt they should have all pulled over and let me go, you know, but they didn't seem so inclined. So, but I want you to know I didn't hurt anybody. And I thought, you know, this is a good growth opportunity for me. So are we just pretending? We want to know God. We want to understand God. And as we do, then it'll help us in our relationship with Him. Many want to obey God, but the walk of faith as we're trying to pursue that is hard. The questions we have are questions like, what should we expect from God? What should we expect Him to do for us now? Or what doesn't He do? What should we ask for? What shouldn't we ask for? And the Christian tradition in our country, in America, makes it even harder. Because you hear all sorts of voices saying, God will do this for you. God will do that for you. If I use a phrase here that you particularly like, you can deal with it, okay? But we have these phrases about prayer that are very odd phrases. And they could be fine. And I'm really treading on soft ground because this may be like your motto. If this is your motto, you can get up and walk out or throw fruit or something. But they're talking about prayer. They say we should storm the gates of heaven. For the devotional for those guys, I spoke on the book of Job. And if you don't get anything else from the book of Job, you should get the idea that God is big and we are not, right? And that I'm not quite ready at this stage in life to storm the gates of heaven. I don't want you to raise your hand if you are, but it seems a bit bravado to me. Demand of God and accept no less. It's taught. Now I get a little closer to your world. Before we do this, it should be bathed in prayer. What does bathed in prayer mean? The list goes on, and I could get more personal, and then you'd all stomp out, and I'd be talking to myself. So, the problem is somehow we've convinced ourselves that multitude of prayer is going to move God every time. And then we see things in the Bible where somebody prayed fervently and God did what they asked or possibly chose a different action plan than what he was going to choose. And so we think, well, that must apply across the board. But I don't think it does. The danger for prayer for us is when it becomes for us too much of a complex procedure. An established ritual that will convince God to do our bidding. That is the danger for us. We fall into the trap of becoming convinced that we can obligate God to do things that we think He should do. That's what Tony, what we were talking about there. They were listening to an evangelist at a church they were at. Was the term obligate? Obligated. If you do these certain things, God will be obligated to bless you in this visible, material way. And, I guarantee you, now I never look at the offering that's back there, but if God was obligated to bless us in return, that thing would be really full because it would just be a mathematical equation, right? You give 100, you get 1,000, you give 1,000, you get 10,000. We would all be millionaires and we would love God with all our heart through it, right? See, we can't really be trusted with that kind of equation because we would use it for our own accumulation of wealth, which wouldn't be good for us. So God has to hold back from that. He wants to bless us with every good thing, and someday we will. When we're in heaven, we'll enjoy those good things. But for now, in our fallen state, it would corrupt us. So it's not a matter of obligating God to bless us through prayer. If we think He's obligated to do something for us and He doesn't do it, then we condemn Him for failing us, excuse me. But if God is all powerful and He can do what is the right thing, He's never failed anyone. Remember, we looked at Isaiah. We'll look at it briefly. If you have your Bible, fine. If you don't, you can just listen along. Isaiah is before Jeremiah. 55:8-9. I've quoted this once before, and I really like the verses. He says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declared the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." This is the conclusion that Job had to come to through his trials. And it is the conclusion that we should be coming to as well. The purpose of our spiritual journey is to unite us with the God who created us in a close communion. That communion is the goal of his work with us and in us. And he wants to bring us back to the closeness we had with him when in the garden. When Adam and Eve fell in the garden, away from God, they just didn't fall a little ways. They fell a long, 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 and even longer, if I kept saying long, it still wouldn't be long enough, ways. His goal then is to restore us to that closeness, to remove sin from creation, and that's a job only God can do. Remember, we said you can't even remove sin from your own life, no matter how hard you try. You certainly aren't doing it with others. The only people who can remove sin from society are politicians. And that was supposed to be funny. I'm sorry. But, they claim that given enough money and enough time, they can remove all of society's woes. But we know that's not true because sin is buried deep within us. And no matter how much we change the exterior culture, the interior is still corrupt until God gets a hold of it and remodels it. So then prayer becomes essential. It's the cry of our soul, the cry of our innermost being. God, what can I do? It is our response to a God who's moving us from a deeply entrenched position. And that deeply entrenched position is that somehow we can earn merit with God. We can force his hand to do something if we focus long enough. And we see most strong religious efforts try to prove to their people that if you do these acts, you will earn merit with God. If you pray long enough, if you pray for each something, each bead or each whatever you do, that somehow that will earn a special merit with God. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with using material things to try to help us remember to pray. And if you developed your own specific method, I think that can be very God-honoring. There are times when I have prayed regularly from a list, and I don't think that's wrong. And God may have heard me say that for the last 30 days, but I don't think he's offended because it's still in my heart and I still care for the person. As long as I'm praying to him and not just listing the list to the atmosphere. Last week we viewed briefly the simple communication between Adam and Eve and God. It was perfect and it was meaningful, but then it was lost. Sin changed it. And as soon as sin came into the equation, the simple interaction was altered. We saw Adam lies to God. But this doesn't seem very bright to me when you were that close to him just that soon. Does he really think he can deceive God? He doesn't man up and admit he's wrong. And then later, Cain, after killing his brother, he has the nerve to ask God, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And when God says, "Where's your brother?" he goes, "I don't know." This is the kind of deception that we fall into. Now, if we continue in Genesis just a little bit longer, in these few historical chapters, humankind has reached a seriously low ebb. Within just the first few chapters, we've reached the story of Noah in the Bible, the story where all other families are no longer praying to God. There's one family left that, and it's only by Genesis 12, or earlier than that, by Genesis 12, Abraham comes onto the situation. Now, Abraham gets a lot of chapters here. He gets about 10 chapters or somewhere around there. Did you ever study Abraham? How did Abraham get to be in such an honorable position by God? If you read his life, the guy was kind of a bozo. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, he doesn't do really smart things. I certainly want to be married to him. You know, he doesn't treat his wife well. He has a hard time seeing how God's going to convince his or complete his promise to him. So there's there's all sorts of things that Abraham did that are just shocking to me. I think I measure up pretty good to him, at least in the things that I choose to measure up. The problem is somehow Abraham had a really, really heart for God, and God knew that. And despite his human frailty, he did some really incredible things to try to have faith. And I appreciate the fact, I guess, that he makes these silly mistakes, but I also appreciate the fact that God commits to him. Somehow God creates a relationship with Adam that is unique. It's close and personable. And it's obviously not based on Adam's performance, right? Because if it was based on Adam's performance, that relationship would have ended a long time ago, and it didn't. Abraham was not confident in God's presence. He didn't tell God. He asked God. In Genesis 15:2, he addresses God as, O Sovereign Lord. And Lord is that all capitals that we've talked about a few different times, meaning the God of personal relationship. He's very personally connected with God. In 15:8, he addresses himself as, O Sovereign Lord. I kind of like that address. In fact, that's the thing that Job was condemned for, by the way, for losing the sight of God's sovereignty through his trials. He didn't say God didn't exist. He just didn't. He didn't have faith that what God was doing was the very best thing, because it didn't seem like the very best thing at that moment. The whole life of Abraham could be a long study, but we're not going to do that. But I would suggest, if you want to try to isolate some things that move God to have a relationship with man, that you study the life of Abraham. There's a lot of chapters. I might encourage you in your own journey. See, Abraham put God in his proper place. He put him as ascendance above himself. Not as a co-equal, not as a means to an end, but an end in himself. And then in Genesis 15:6, you guys all know this verse, and you've seen it reinforced in the New Testament. It says, Abraham believed the Lord, and it was credited him as righteousness. It's worth noting that this is the time God spoke to mankind in a very clear and understandable way. Now I'm going to go off for a minute on a topic that is very, I don't really want to go off on, but it might help you, because the Old Testament keeps saying, well, God spoke to the person and then he spoke back. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't really have that kind of relationship with God right now. And in an effort to understand how God deals differently with people at different times, theological people have come up with the idea of dispensations. Are you familiar with this term at all? And, you know, there are seven classic dispensations. And you can accept dispensations or not. People define different ones. But we know that God has not always dealt with all people exactly the same. Just let me give you. God dealt with people differently before the fall than after. God dealt with differently with people after the law was given by Moses than before, because once the law of Moses came along, you had to offer sacrifices for your sin. You didn't have to do that before. After Jesus came for us and died for us, we no longer have to offer sacrifices. So this is the idea. There are times when God has dealt with humankind differently. Now, God is sovereign. He can do what he wants, and I'm not trying to come up with an excuse for why he doesn't give me an oral order or a discernible order to me personally. But these things can vary, and it's important for you to come to grips with your own opinion why God spoke more easily to interpret than maybe it is for us. We walk by more by faith than by sight, more by trust than by the actual verbal voice of God. And if you believe you have to have the verbal voice of God, then you could be in trouble, because you're going to demand that it comes, and if it doesn't come, you're going to try to create it. Anybody read the book Black Elk Speaks? Anybody know this book? It's a main Christian bestseller. Just kidding, it's not. It's about an Indian shaman from the 1880s. He's born. He's predicted at his birth that he's going to Well, what does every Indian believe that would be the ideal situation in the 1880s? Drive the white men from the land and the buffalo will return. So they send him on what then was called a vision quest. He has to go out into the wilderness and he has to get his vision for life. And it just so happens when he goes out, and they give him some peyote buttons, if you know what those are, hallucinogens, and help him to get the vision he needs. But you can't come back to the tribe until you've had your vision. So eventually when you're hungry, it becomes pretty essential that you have your vision. Well, he has a vision, and his vision is the perfect vision for an Indian of that day. He will drive the white men from the land and the buffalo will return. You know, I think that it was a noble effort. I think he wanted to do a good thing, some sort of heroic deed for his people. This is the danger, though. This didn't happen in his lifetime. So if you have this vision, or you've imagined words from God that maybe God didn't give you, and they don't come to fruition, there's probably lots of conclusions, but I'm going to simplify it as two. Number one, your vision was wrong. But that's hard to come by. You don't want to say that. So the other one you fall back on is, well, I didn't prove worthy. I just wasn't a worthy enough person that my vision worked out. But you can stay out of that trouble if you don't try to assume that you've got a specific word from the Lord that you can't confirm, that you think you have to live up to. Because if you end up being wrong, you've let a lot of people down. And it's better not to assume that you know before you actually do know. So anyway, during these times when they seem to have heard the voice of God very clearly, that's awesome. It may not happen for you like that. There are many examples of prayer and interaction with God in the Bible. We're going to look at a few, and I wanted to look at Daniel, but I think we'll hold off till next week because I don't want to start on that. It's going to take us too late. But the goal is continual, and I use the word as I think it should be used. The goal is continual communion with God, interaction with God every moment of every day. That's the goal of his work in us and through us. That's what we saw when we studied the book in Matthew. It's not a matter of dominance over us. It's not guilt or rigorous discipline. He said to his followers, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." The goal is our daily fellowship with our Creator. When this occurs, everything is different. In sports, you'd say it's a game changer. There are not parts of our lives he's not involved with. There is no dichotomy. We have communion with him in its sweetest form. And when we have that, when that begins to restore to us, it changes our entire life. I can no longer set through the movie that maybe I would have set through before he invaded my being to its deepest core. I can no longer treat someone carelessly because I hear the still small voice of God saying, "You're careless. Don't be careless." When we start to talk with God in continual communion with him rather than intermittent times. And we'll look at Daniel. And Daniel's a kind of an interesting person because he gives God three times a day, if you remember the story. And that's awesome. And I think Daniel was the guy who was also walking with God in between the three times a day. You see, some of us have developed the idea that, well, we'll just give God his moments and then we'll go do our thing. If we look at the history of our own nation, we look at, I told you before, I love history. And I look at the Civil War and I say that, you know, you go to church and you pray to God and then you go home to your slaves and beat them for not doing enough work on your plantation. Well, that's easily condemning the South, but you could condemn the North the same way. I mean, there was slavery in the North in terms of child labor and all these kind of things. So I'm not just condemning any one culture. See, we dichotomize. We have a Christian part and we have a secular part. And it's not until God gets into every part that he burns deep into every part of what you're doing that all of a sudden our faith becomes really genuine. It affects everything I do. It affects how I pour a piece of concrete, how I sell insurance, how I fix a plane, how I heal a physical body that's broken. It doesn't matter. When God gets into all those parts, the deepest core of us, and there's continual interaction with Him, all of a sudden our faith begins to be more than just religion. But that close personal relationship that God meant for us to have in our walk with Him. Let's pray. God, we are just humans who we feel are called to walk by faith right now to a certain extent. We know You do great things. And we're not limiting You. We know You do things all around the world that we cannot even imagine that You're doing. But You do them in a sovereign way in Your time for the very best of Your creation. Thank You for being kind to us and loving us. Help us to be mindful of You in all that we do. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen.